Science and technology are an increasingly large part of our lives. We take a look at the interface between science and history, economics, philosophy, ethics, religion, and culture. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm your host, Elizabeth Fernandez. Space. It's huge and mostly empty, but this is by no means true in the immediate vicinity around the Earth. Space there is anything but spacious. It's crowded with all sorts of derelict junk. Non-functioning satellites, frozen bits of coolant, paint flecks, astronauts' tools, and even a toothbrush. So where did all this junk come from? And is it dangerous? Should we consider expanding our green movement into space? Here to talk to us today is Dr. Lisa Ruth Rand. Lisa is a Mellon Postdoctoral Fellow for the Institute of Research in the Humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is currently writing a book on the history of space junk. So welcome to the podcast, Lisa.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
Where is all this space junk coming from, and what kind of things are up there in space surrounding the Earth right now?
Space junk comes from a multitude of sources. Really, anything that any spacefaring entity, whether it's a state or a company, puts into outer space, once that object stops functioning, it's designated as space junk. So at an international level, space junk is defined as any object designed for use in outer space that no longer serves a designated purpose. And that can be objects that remain in orbit and no longer are functioning, or returning to Earth from outer space. So anything that no longer serves a purpose, which is kind of a tricky designation if you think about it, because there are some things that are up in outer space that might have value to one person or group that doesn't have value to others. Really, one person's trash is another person's treasure applies in outer space as well.
So is there a specific orbit that a lot of this junk is located at?
So we've put stuff in all different kinds of orbits. The most currently crowded orbit is a low Earth orbit, which extends to some 2,000 kilometers and below, above the surface. So objects at that altitude circle the Earth at speeds of up to 7 or 8 kilometers per second, which, as you might imagine, at speeds that high, even small objects can really pack a punch.
Yeah.
NASA uses uses an analogy, an object smaller than 1/2 inch around, traveling at about 6 miles per second, would hit as hard as a bowling ball moving at 300 miles per hour. So even small flecks of debris that have fallen off of a satellite or off of a rocket body, that can cause a lot of damage. But you know, there's a lot of stuff up there, a lot of functioning satellites, but also detritus, debris from the launch of those satellites. So one big source of space debris is empty rocket bodies, pieces of the rockets that sent our satellites up into space, into orbit, and then remain circling the planet until they reenter the atmosphere. But debris can also be, as you mentioned, objects shed, you know, whether an astronaut drops a spatula or a toothbrush or flecks of paint or screws shed from operating spacecraft. There's lots and lots of stuff up there circling the planet at those low Earth orbits. But I should also note that there's still a lot of space in space. It's not like if you were traveling along as an astronaut that you would necessarily be able to see objects swirling around you. It's not that congested. Mm-hmm. But with objects moving that quickly and with the amount of debris mounting, it's still very much a concern for satellite operators, and especially for craft like the International Space Station with people on board. It's important to know where those objects are at all times and make sure that they don't come into close contact with any of our operating spacecraft.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a lot of room up there. I mean, space is still big, no matter how you mm-hmm. define it. But still, there are so many things up there in space. Like, is there a current count of how many little bits of things are flying around up there?
Yes. So at current estimate, there's about 500,000 objects 1 centimeter or larger, but we can only track some 23,000 of those, which is really only 5% of the total objects of that size that we can see from the ground, because currently our space surveillance sensors can only track objects about 10 centimeters or larger. So there's likely over 100 million particles smaller than 1 centimeter that we can't really see flying around up there. We're currently, the Space Surveillance Network is going to eventually add a new space fence to its group of sensors that will be able to, that by using S-band radar, should be able to track smaller objects, but it's not quite online yet. So right now, we can track approximately 23,000 of those derelict objects, but ultimately that's a pretty small fraction of the total number of debris artifacts that are currently in orbit.
Yeah. And so talking about some of the things that are actually floating around up there and how they get there. So when astronauts go up into space, I imagine, I mean, just like people down here on Earth, they generate trash. And so is it common practice to just jettison the trash when in space? And is that part of the problem that is up there?
That's an interesting question. So I have noticed that in terms of space litter, you know, the actual act of tossing something out into space by hand, so to speak, the United States tends to do that a lot less often. Our astronauts tend to do that a lot less often than Russian cosmonauts do. But in the past, it was a semi-common practice. For instance, there are multiple what are essentially garbage bags on the moon. And interestingly enough, the very first photograph that Neil Armstrong took during his first main moonwalk features a bag full of junk underneath the lunar module. So, and then in another Apollo mission returning from space, I believe it was Apollo 16, the astronauts performed an extravehicular activity or spacewalk on the way back to Earth, and they opened the hatch. And one of the first things they did was toss out a bag of debris. And I believe one of them even said, bye bye bag. And there it went out into the space between Earth and the moon. But generally, you know, when these resupply missions go to the space station to provide, you know, new supplies for the astronauts, oftentimes it'll be packed with things that they no longer need to be returned. You know, typically these, especially the ones that are the resupply craft that are single use, are not meant to survive the fall, will disintegrate in the atmosphere, and the garbage along with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that story you mentioned about Neil Armstrong bringing his trash out on the moon, I actually noticed that. I brought up the picture, the first picture he took, and sure enough, there's that bag of trash sitting mm-hmm. in the background.
They call them jettison bags, or jet bags for short. And they put all kinds of things in there, but including apparently human waste, human feces. So there's a certain amount of just poop on the moon that will be up there for millennia. They are still on the moon. There's really nothing to really cause them to change in any way. There's, you know, there's not like there's microbes or atmosphere or any of the things that we rely upon to degrade our wastes here on Earth. Uh-huh. Those just don't exist on the moon. So they're there for the foreseeable future until we go back or until someone else visits, you know, those things are, or perhaps a meteor hits for whatever reason, you know, those objects will stay there indefinitely until disrupted by some outside force. They probably will outlive us. The astronauts' poop will probably outlive, you know, they definitely have outlived the astronauts themselves. And I mean, Neil Armstrong is no longer with us, but his poop is still up on the moon.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting bit of archaeology. If anyone is to come along in the future and find this, it'll still be there and be sort of a gold mine archaeologically.
Yes. And in fact, there are several archaeologists who are working on preserving those sites as cultural heritage sites. Alice Gorman comes immediately to mind. She's an archaeologist working out of Australia. One of her main priorities in her research is trying to find ways to preserve those landing sites, including the things on there that may not be, that may not seem all that valuable, like the jet bags, that nonetheless still exist as sites of cultural heritage. Even though no one may be able to visit, we should still preserve them from potential interventions, whether we return to the moon, make sure that they, you know, that they stay protected and like any national monuments on the Earth.
A lot of your research has to do with the history of space junk during the Cold War, which I find really interesting because people looked at space very differently than what we do right now. And one interesting story during the Cold War is that the United States actually thought to put a bunch of little bits of copper wire up into orbit to try to make a copper ring around the Earth. Have you heard about this?
Absolutely. There's an entire chapter of my forthcoming book. Yeah. It was called Project Westford. And what I think is so interesting about this project, and it was really one of the motivating factors for my writing this piece of research, was that it revealed that perhaps our understanding of space as a place that could be polluted was not so new. It's not so recent as a lot of current space policymakers argue, and it's not as recent as a lot of us might imagine just on the surface. So Project Westford was initially called Project Needles, and it was an Air Force funded project that was intended to seed Earth orbit at about 3,500 kilometers with these tiny copper fibers to serve as a kind of artificial ionosphere. Now, the ionosphere is a part of the atmosphere that's crucial for certain types of radio communications. It's used to as basically a scattering medium to bounce our signals off, to allow them to travel from one place to the other. And it may sound a little crazy, this idea of putting hundreds of millions of copper fibers into space from our perspective now, But ultimately, I argue that it was a really elegant solution to a real geopolitical problem at the time. So this design, this idea came, was first proposed in 1958. It was launched twice, first in 1961. The dipoles, the copper fibers did not successfully deploy. And they tried again in 1963, and they did successfully deploy, and they were able to use that system to transmit a signal from one side of North America to the other. And at the same time that they were designing and deploying the system, both the United States and the Soviet Union were engaging in high altitude nuclear tests. So basically detonating nukes in the nearest reaches of outer space. And what that in many cases did was disrupt that ionosphere, generate a layer of fissile material that disrupted that really important layer of atmosphere and made it sometimes impossible even to communicate using certain kinds of radio technology. So in that particular geopolitical reality, what would be a resilient way to make sure that the president could stay in touch with the nuclear arsenal deployed around the world? Well, one way to do that would be to launch this cheap, resilient cloud of copper fibers that could be used to transmit microwave signals. So by the time the second project deployed and was successfully used, however, the state of the art had kind of shifted. The partial nuclear test ban treaty had been accepted and signed, so there were no longer any atmospheric nuclear tests, so that perhaps made such a system obsolete. But really, at the time that it was designed, it made a lot of sense. And it was also designed, I should note, to come back to Earth within a 3 to 5 year time span. So it was meant to be short-lived, this particular test. At the time when it was first launched, a lot of astronomers in particular were extremely concerned that not so much about the test itself, but what might happen if that would become the way of the future, if that became state-of-the-art, if every nation wanted to launch its own far more dense band of dipoles of copper fibers into space, what might that do in terms of astronomers' ability to observe the cosmos? It would perhaps doom them from ever being able to escape from all of the disruptions of the urban atmosphere, would extend into outer space and make it difficult to see past these artificial objects into the cosmos. So astronomers were very, very clear from the late 1950s on that they were concerned about the pollution of outer space and the fact that the things that we put up there will be hard to control, and we would really be relying on the whim of outer space itself to clean up our messes for us. And they were not willing to take that risk. So again, this awareness has been around since the beginning of the space age, really. It's just not one that, for whatever reason, Westford has been forgotten in the popular memory, and also among astronomers too. I've talked to many of them that had never even heard of this project. But at the same time, astronomers continue to be perennial watchdogs in some ways. So for instance, when Rocket Lab launched the Humanity Star that just recently re-entered the atmosphere, it was the shiny geodesic sphere that was launched only for the purposes of being visible from the ground to foster unity across the Earth. And astronomers called it space graffiti. They were concerned that this thing would, could get in the way of their observations. So this has happened periodically. Yeah, this has happened periodically throughout the course of the last few decades of the space age. But that idea that this is a new concern is just, historically, that's just not the case. There's been concern about space junk from the very, very beginning.
The story about the copper wire is interesting. Like you said, it's a very elegant solution, coming up with this idea of using all these little bits of copper wire that are essentially acting as antennas. And you mentioned that they were meant to only last a few years up in orbit, but are they still there? Are they still floating around the Earth?
Unfortunately, some of them still are, and that was by virtue of an imperfect deployment. So the reason why they were designed, the way that they were supposed to come back was that they had a specific kind of mass to surface area ratio that would allow solar pressure to decay the orbits of those objects to reenter within that short time span. However, the dipoles unevenly deployed and clumped together, and that destroyed the mass to area ratio, which meant that some of them stayed aloft in those clumps. So, in fact, if you go online, some of these online tracking databases, you can search for Westford, and it will show you some of those clumps that have been identified as clumps of Westford dipoles. They're still up there. It's still orbiting the Earth. Some of them still at a very high orbit, close to that 3,500 kilometer altitude that they originally were launched to. So, the individual ones, for the most part, have all come back, but those clumps with that changed mass to surface area ratio remain aloft.
And so back in the Cold War, was this pretty typical to put stuff in orbit and not really worry about the consequences?
Well, I would say that, I mean, the consequences, they were worrying about the consequences. For instance, the Lincoln Lab, the MIT Lincoln Laboratory, were the ones who designed Westford with Air Force funding. And it was a secret project at first, but they ultimately decided to go at least partially public with it in order to get astronomers involved, in order to get their opinions on whether or not this would be safe for their practice. So, so this wasn't a matter of just launching anything willy-nilly into outer space. There was some care taken in making sure that experts could weigh in. And eventually that was codified in the 1967 Outer Space Treaty that international scientific communities should be consulted before any state would launch a space project that might cause contamination of the outer space environment.
So how are things different now? Do countries have a different type of viewpoint for putting things in orbit, putting satellites? I mean, there's a lot more satellites now than there were back then. Mm-hmm. Are people thinking about the possibility of polluting space around the Earth with space junk?
Absolutely. In fact, you're asking this question at a very interesting time. So to start with, I should note that there are currently no international binding agreements about how to reduce the amount of space junk. Different states, different nations have different codes that they follow themselves to produce less debris. For instance, you know, some countries have the requirement that that all rockets need to be designed to vent extra fuel once they reach orbit so that they don't become an explosion hazard. So once you vent the fuel, you no longer have this pressurized risk of the object exploding and creating more fragments of debris. Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and the like are working on building these reusable rockets that will remove the rocket bodies to orbit to begin with. But the problem with all of these codes and rules is that they all rely upon the technology working as designed. And sometimes technologies fail, right? So that said, there's also a current movement. A lot of different private companies and also state space programs are working on designing new kinds of technologies to remove space debris from orbit that are extremely tricky legally. But first, I should note that we're actually in a moment of controversy right now and with two kind of important things that are happening when it comes to space debris. One being the reentry of the Tiangong-1 Chinese space station. That's supposed to happen any day now. It was an uncontrolled reentry because China lost contact with the space station within the last few years, and that object can no longer be led into a controlled reentry, which objects that still have control of the ground often can be guided to fall over a particular part of the Pacific Ocean that's called the satellite graveyard, the space junk graveyard. But this object, which is about roughly the size of a small bus, is going to fall back to Earth without any sort of input from the ground. So there's a little bit of concern right now about where it might fall, if it might cause any damage to property or environments or people. The likelihood that it actually will strike anyone or any point on the ground is highly low because our Earth is covered with 3/4 ocean, but also even if it were to hit land, there's a lot of land that doesn't have people living on it. So the chances of it actually causing a hazard to people is extremely low. But that said, it's just still something that's causing a lot of press. This has happened over and over and over over the course of decades. When Skylab fell in 1979, that was the very first American space station. It happened during a pretty slow news cycle, and it became a major phenomenon around the world of people wearing you know, manufacturing and wearing t-shirts with targets on them. This very macabre sense of humor about what might happen should Skylab strike ground. And eventually it did. It fell into a part of the Australian outback. No one was hurt, but several large pieces of debris were recovered. You know, objects as large as an oxygen tank, which is about the size of a love seat, recovered and put on display. NASA was fined $400 by the local government in Esperance. I'm probably mispronouncing that. This local government in this region of Australia. So that's one issue. And the other issue, which hasn't gotten as much press, is that a startup out of Silicon Valley, a startup called Swarm, recently defied an FCC order by launching a very, very small microsatellite called a Space Bee. So Swarm intends to launch a bunch of very small satellites in order to create a kind of the Internet of Things, right? To expand the reach of the Internet of connectivity using these very, very small satellites deployed into a kind of constellation, similar to what we have with GPS or the Iridium communication satellites. And the reason why their application was denied by the FCC is that these experimental versions of their satellites are smaller than 10 centimeters in one dimension, at least one dimension, which means that they cannot be tracked from the ground. As I mentioned earlier, 10 centimeters is the threshold right now. So the FCC denied that application, but Swarm ended up launching a few of these satellites anyway aboard an Indian rocket a couple of weeks ago. So this is unprecedented, as far as we know, that a company would defy the FCC rules. We don't quite know what's going to happen just yet, what the fallout might be from that. I do know that based on the 1972 Liability Convention, which was an addition to the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, both the states that create, that build a satellite, and the state that launches it are jointly and severally liable for any damage inflicted by that object. So it remains to be seen what will happen, if there will be any sort of sanctions placed on this company. The game's really changing with the entry of all of these small private companies into the space game. So the lack of a binding international agreement for how to deal with space junk is really being thrown into relief by these two major events that are happening right now.
So you mentioned with the Chinese space station that could potentially come down back to Earth, even if it doesn't hit anybody, of course, which is a very small chance. But is there a chance that it could contaminate the environment? I mean, I don't know if there's anything dangerous on the space station or in space junk in general that could come down and be a source of pollution.
It could be. In fact, one of the challenging things about this reentry is that China is being a bit secretive about certain aspects of this object. It may have hydrazine fuel on board, which is extremely hazardous. So different groups like the Aerospace Corporation are suggesting that if anyone were to encounter a piece of this debris, to keep a distance because it might be dangerous. It might have this hydrazine fuel on board. Mm-hmm. And this is not the first time something like this has happened. In fact, in 1978, a nuclear-powered satellite that was launched and operated by the Soviet Union fell to solid ground in the Canadian Arctic. And it was in a sparsely populated area, but still an area where many communities lived, particularly indigenous communities, Dene and Inuit communities, lived in proximity to the crash site. And there was quite a bit of concern about what might happen if these radioactive shards or radioactive particles were to enter their food ways, right? If it was absorbed by lichen, which could then be ingested by caribou and then ingested by people, mm-hmm. or enter the water, make the water unsafe to drink, or make fish unsafe to eat. So this has happened before. There's a precedent for it. This is highly unlikely that this has any nuclear material on board, but that hydrazine fuel, again, is still very dangerous and should be left alone until the proper authorities with expertise can assess it and make sure that it's safe.
Yeah. So, of course, the chance of someone getting hit by any piece of space junk is very low, but has it happened before?
It has. A woman in Oklahoma was the only person so far to have been confirmed to be hit by a piece of space debris, and she was fine. It ended up being a piece of mesh shed by a piece of space junk. So it just glanced off her shoulder and she was fine, but it was confirmed to have in fact been originated from a piece of space junk. So she's the only person who's been confirmed to have been directly hit by a piece of space junk. Although pieces have been recovered by individuals all over the world, these objects can land anywhere, often very, very far from the state that launched them initially. And when people recover them by treaty, they're supposed to return those objects back to the state that owned that designed and launched that object. In practice, it can be a little more malleable than that.
Yeah. So one thing I'm curious, of course, I've watched meteor showers before. I'm sure a lot of people have seen meteors. Is there a way to tell if you see a meteor or what looks to be a meteor streaking through the sky, if it's actually a natural meteor or if it is like a piece of space junk coming back down to the Earth?
As far as I know, I mean, unless you can sort of tell certain kinds of nuances that you probably wouldn't be able to tell with the naked eye, generally it would be impossible to tell for these little tiny objects, right? So like a shooting star here and there, it's usually objects that are the size of, you know, a grain of sand or a tiny little fleck, you know, whether or not that's part of a tail of a comet or a micrometeoroid or a fleck of paint, it would be really hard to tell by the casual observer. But the larger objects, things that generate giant fireballs or explosions, that can happen whether it's a large piece of debris or a large meteorite. And that kind of being able to tell, often it's the kind of thing where you have to know what it is. And generally by the time an object reenters, something that's large enough to create a fireball reenters, the Space Surveillance Network and also even amateur astronomers who track these kinds of things are usually aware at that point when and where it's going to come down and are able to identify, oh, that fireball is a piece of this piece of of space junk. This happened in 2015 with the object that became affectionately known as WTF. It it was called that because of its identifier number had WTF in it. And it also was a very mysterious object. They weren't really sure what it was. They think it might have been a piece of a Saturn V moon rocket. It came to Earth and eventually, you know, weren't sure where it was going to land. But then by the time it did reenter, it was clear that it would be reentering somewhere near Sri Lanka. And observers were able to take pictures of it from the ground and were aware of what it was if they had been paying attention to the news or had been paying attention to Twitter or other announced places where you could learn where things were going to fall. So sometimes it's hard to tell exactly where something's going to fall in advance because Earth's atmosphere perturbs the motion of an uncontrolled object. It makes it tumble through space. And so when an object is behaving that erratically, it's hard to predict exactly when and where it will fall. If it's a controlled reentry, that's another story. But when it's something like WTF that has been in space for a long time, that's not being controlled from the ground, it can be really difficult to really accurately predict a when and where it will reenter. But if you're aware at a moment close to the reentry that it's going to be falling near you and you look up and see a fireball, you can conclude with some accuracy that it was an object of artificial origin.
The astronauts up in space are, of course, at more of a risk for the space junk and also all the satellites we have up there and things like that. And so how much of it is a risk for these people? Like, is this something that they really have to monitor where all the space junk is and kind of take into account? How dangerous would it be for a piece of space junk to hit, like, say, the space station?
So the space station was built with the orbital debris environment in mind. The sort of forward-facing part of the space station is built with extra shielding to protect against smaller debris. But when it comes to larger debris, there have been many instances over a decade, you know, that the space station has been in orbit, that a larger piece of debris has come into close conjunction with the space station. When this happens, when a piece of debris makes a close approach to the space station, the station's operators have to determine whether or not the risk of collision is high enough that the astronauts need to take proactive measures to protect themselves, whether that's moving to a more highly shielded part of the station or taking shelter in the Soyuz module, which could allow them to make a getaway should a piece of debris strike the station and cause it to become disabled or cause it to no longer be able to sustain the astronauts' lives.
So have there been really dangerous collisions either with the space station or with satellites?
Yes. So some of those were intentional and some of them weren't. So in 2007, China attempted to take down a non-functioning weather satellite. It was their own satellite. And so they sent up a projectile to basically shoot the satellite out of the sky. It didn't go as well as planned, and it instead generated a plume of hundreds of thousands of pieces of smaller debris clustered around the orbit of that satellite. And that a lot of the debris is still up there. Some of it has reentered, but some of it remains aloft. And 2 years later, in 2009, a functioning Iridium communications satellite collided with a non-functioning Russian Cosmos satellite. It was the first unintentional, accidental, catastrophic head-on collision between two objects in space. Both objects were destroyed, and two plumes of debris generated along their former orbital paths. And those pieces of debris from both of those incidences do threaten functioning satellites in the space station somewhat regularly. These debris artifacts do threaten our infrastructure in outer space on a semi-regular basis.
For those people who have seen the movie Gravity, now I think it begins with a very interesting sequence where pieces of space debris start crashing into each other and leads to a chain reaction. More and more bits of space debris crash into each other. And this is actually something that I guess it potentially could actually happen, called the Kessler syndrome, I guess. Is this actually something that is a threat?
So the Kessler syndrome is a real thing. You described it well. It's an idea that once enough collisions start happening, they might set a chain reaction in motion that could eventually become uncontrollable and destroy a lot of our satellites. It's named after Donald Kessler, who was a NASA engineer who came up with this idea back in the late 70s, so pretty early on. And the scenario presented in Gravity is one that's not physically possible. It happens far too quickly at too many different altitudes to actually happen in our current reality. But the idea of a cascading collisions is something that's very real. And we've seen that with the outcome of these two major debris-producing events, the 2007 Chinese ASAT test and the 2009 Iridium Cosmos collision, that pieces of those debris have come into close approaches with other functioning satellites, you know, forcing the operators of those satellites and spacecraft to make some difficult decisions. So I should also note that when it comes to gravity, one of the things that I found most interesting about that film was that there's only one brief moment in the dialogue where they refer to what might be happening on the ground at the same time. I believe that astronaut Kowalski, who's played by George Clooney, says something like, he's communicating with ground control, who tells them that all of the satellites have been destroyed. All of them. So this is presuming that everything from objects, satellites in low Earth orbit to GPS satellites, everything has been destroyed. And George Clooney's character says, well, half of North America just lost their Facebook. It's a very flippant remark, right? And yet, to me, what's most interesting about the idea of this kind of a crisis, if something like gravity were to happen, or even a fraction of what happened in gravity were to occur, and we were to lose a significant portion of our satellite infrastructure, yes, some astronauts' lives might be threatened by swirling debris, but what's most interesting to me is what would happen on the ground. So when I refer to satellites as an infrastructure, what I mean is that they are a kind of technological system that is so integrated into multiple technological practices on the ground that it becomes all but invisible to the majority of users of that system. So for instance, the electrical grid being an infrastructure, we don't really notice that infrastructure until it stops working, till the lights go off. And then you notice, oh, that infrastructure is failing me right now. And with satellites, it wouldn't be as evident as the lights going off. It would just be kind of something that we would almost feel in our bodies, that something's not right, that things aren't working the way that we're used to them working. It wouldn't be something visible. We wouldn't notice that our satellites were not working. But trying to take money out of an ATM, you wouldn't be able to do that because they're connected. Most of them are connected to GPS satellites. Our phone calls, our cell phones, calls would get dropped more often because of cell phone towers also being attached to satellites. Any sort of financial transaction we try to make using the internet, anything with that requires these complex time and location interactions. And it would take quite a bit of time to rebuild, to try to build new ways to revive these technological systems if we were to lose all of our satellites that quickly.
But most importantly, we wouldn't have Facebook.
Right. Although some people, I think, would think now that that would be a good thing.
Yeah. So what can we do about this then? Are there ways we could try to clean up all this space junk before it gets more and more crowded up there?
There are several national space agencies and also private companies, startups that are working on ways to remove debris from orbit. These range from everything from Airbus has designed a harpoon that's meant to be shot into larger pieces of debris and drag it back into the atmosphere to be destroyed. There's a Japanese company that's building a prototype that's based on fishing net technologies. NASA's developing a debris removal system that's modeled on gecko's feet. So those kind of the grasping abilities that gecko's feet exhibit, using that model to grab onto things that are no longer being used to drag them back to the atmosphere. The Swiss have a project called Clean Space One that they're also using to try to retrieve an object of their own to return to Earth, which I always think is kind of funny that the Swiss, of course, are the ones that are leading the way with this of cleaning up our mess. But what's interesting to me about this is that, so this is all these activities, this idea of active removal of debris that's already up there, that's what's known as remediation. Another way of dealing with debris is called mitigation. So producing less debris and allowing the outer space environment to clean up the mess for us. So every time an object reenters, whether it's Tiangong 1 or a smaller satellite or a CubeSat, that happens because Earth's atmosphere expands much further out into space than some might know. These atmospheric particles extend into space hundreds of thousands of kilometers out and exert friction on anything that we put up into those low Earth orbits. And depending on how much solar energy is being put out that year, objects will fall back to Earth, will succumb to that friction and pressure and gravity and fall back to Earth and usually disintegrate in the atmosphere, or any pieces that survive fall into the ocean. It's a kind of self-cleaning mechanism that Mother Nature has provided for us, especially if we're able to manufacture satellites that can be carefully controlled in their reentry, or that are small enough to not really cause a threat in the moment of reentry. Outer space really does that work for us. It's really remarkable. So by creating less debris in low Earth orbit to begin with, it's possible that, and there's been some modeling done to suggest this is the case, near Earth space could clean a lot of that low Earth orbit for us. Now, artifacts in higher orbits, particularly in the geostationary orbit, it's this very unique orbit in which objects that we put into it orbit the Earth at the same time that the Earth turns. So objects in that orbit appear to remain stationary above a fixed point on the ground. So as you might imagine, this is extremely valuable, particularly for communications satellites that where you don't want interruption. You want uninterrupted service because it will never go behind the planet. That said, it's very much a limited resource. There's only 360 degrees of it. And it's so high up that if something goes wrong, there's not much that we can do about it. So that particular orbit, things in that orbit are up there pretty much indefinitely. They'll stay up for millennia. The sun will go red giant before objects in higher orbit come back to Earth.
So is there a chance that the geostationary orbit will get pretty crowded then?
Yes. Now, some newer satellites have been engineered to be removed at the end of that satellite's functional lifetime. They can be maneuvered to what's called a graveyard orbit. It's up to each individual nation or operator to decide to do that because there are no binding rules about this. But there are norms. There may not be laws, but there are norms. We want to behave well in geostationary orbit if we want everyone else to behave well. So we need to make sure that we're cleaning up after ourselves, since Mother Nature can't really do it for us at that point. Although it does, there are, interestingly enough, there are gravity wells even at that high of an altitude where objects that we're no longer controlling in that orbit do eventually congregate.
All different countries have space junk. So I'm curious, in the effort to clean up, is there a little bit of international tension? It's like, well, you know, maybe one country doesn't want another country to be cleaning up their own derelict satellites because potentially they could find some technology from that country that they don't want them to know. Is that a problem?
Yeah. So that was actually a major tension early in the space age when things would reenter. So the very first large object to reenter the atmosphere was a piece of the rocket that launched Sputnik 1 to space, the very first artificial moon. And there was some debate. There was a little bit of back and forth between the Soviet Union and the United States about where this object landed. The United States argued that it had fallen over Mongolia, so within Soviet territory. The Soviet Union accused the United States of covering up that it had fallen in Alaska and that perhaps they had recovered it to exploit it for engineering secrets. So this was very much an issue in the early days of the space age. And now a big concern is that, you know, that the Outer Space Treaty and its subsequent revisions have all been designated to attempt to keep space a place that's free of weapons. The space should be the province of all humankind and should not be a war zone. The problem with active remediation of removing things is, as I mentioned earlier, one person's trash is another person's treasure. If we were to say, decide to take down a derelict Russian satellite, if political tensions between our two nations are high at that particular moment, Russia could see that as an act of war, and we do not want to start a space war. Mm-hmm. It's legally very, very tricky because by treaty, that object will remain the property of Russia forever.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you. I enjoy talking about space junk at every opportunity. It'll be a very interesting few years coming up, again, as private space operators become a major force in orbit. We'll see what happens when it comes to the presence or lack thereof of rules and regulations regarding the creation or removal of space debris.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcasts. Join me again in 2 weeks when we'll talk about the danger of using machine learning algorithms to categorize people. We talk about how these algorithms decide who gets parole, what coupons to send you based on your buying habits, and the Trump administration's extreme vetting initiative. If you love this podcast, take a quick moment to subscribe to it or rate it. You could find out how to do either of these on our website, sparkdialogue.com/love. You can find more about this podcast series on sparkdialogue.com, on facebook.com/sparkdialogue, or on Twitter @sparkdialogue. As always, thanks for listening.